So a couple of weeks ago we studied the classical description of the practice of clear comprehension, reminding us to be mindful, to be aware at each moment. I'm just wondering how many of us were practicing that on the way to the cave this evening. I mean, I left the house today, I walked up to the top of the driveway, and my mind was caught up in various thoughts and memories. And then when I got near the top of the driveway, I suddenly realized that I hadn't got hold of my mindfulness. So I grabbed my mindfulness, put it on my feet, walked down the path, and then just kept on trying to do that, kept on trying to do that practice. And then occasionally, once about near where the pine tree is, and another time on the causeway part, my mind went off and lost track for a little bit. When I got to the top bend of the curve, the two rocks coming down to the cave, then I have to confess I felt got feelings of annoyance arising listening to the chatter that was going along. I was trying to be mindful and feeling a sort of sense of me and my practice. I'm trying to be mindful, why can't you be mindful? So there's a kind of unwholesome thought arose at that time. And then coming down the path towards the cave, got my mindfulness together again, and then some thoughts arose about what I was going to talk about this evening, and then got my mindfulness back again, and then just on the last approach up to the cave, again I lost my mindfulness because I discovered in my shoulder bag, I discovered my fob watch, which I thought I'd lost, and there it was in one of the pockets of my bag. So I got very excited for a couple of minutes there. So that was good. So that's the story of my walk from the house to here. And so apart from those things, then pretty much managed to keep the mindfulness with my feet most of the time, not drifting off very much. So that's how to practice. That's how we should be using our time here at the monastery. And the time from walking from the house to the cave is not a waste of time. In fact, it's a fantastic opportunity, and it's quite deliberate choice to make the meditation place and the Dhamma teaching place separate, physically separate from the place where the business happens. And so this is part of the things that we think about when we're designing a monastery. Physically separated, it gives us time to walk, time to collect ourselves, time to shake off those moods, thoughts, memories, the processes of the mind that cling to us like ghosts, like wraiths, jabbering away in our ears, like poltergeists being naughty all the time. And so we shake them all off with the power of mindfulness, bring back our mind to what's actually happening. So this is what this monastery is for, this is what this place here is for, this is why the kutis are out there in the forest. So this is what you're here to do. Practice mindfulness, practice meditation, take the chance. Don't be negligent, don't waste your time. It's so easy in monastic life to let one afternoon drift into an evening drift into a morning, and then it goes around, and one day goes into the next day, one week goes into the next, a month goes into the next, a year goes to another year, and then you look back and you think, what have I done? How have I been spending my time? Have I actually done anything useful with my time? So don't be somebody who comes here with great aspirations to practice and a great love of Dhamma and enthusiasm to meditate and develop spiritually, and then just fritter that away. The faith and inspiration that you have when you arrive, it doesn't last. It's like marriage. A passion only lasts for a few, can only go for a few couple of years on passion. 7 years maximum, this is what they say, chemically. after that it's just grind from then on. So that means you have to develop deeper things, more lasting, more stable things, more realistic, more grounded, more mature, more wise things than mere enthusiasm. I don't know how many people I've seen. I've been a monk for 17 years, 18 years, including being a novice, and every year I've been a monk, that I've stayed in monasteries, whether this monastery or every other monastery I've been at, every year I've seen people arriving full of enthusiasm who are going to break down the walls and beat down defilements and realize nibbana, and then only to leave sooner or later, disillusioned or disappointed and so on. It's because that rush of enthusiasm, it doesn't last. It's just a feeling. There's this great saying of Ajahn Chah where he said, if you feel so diligent and enthusiastic, you really want to meditate, then just throw that feeling out. If you feel lazy and tired, feel like meditation is the last thing you want to do, then just throw that feeling out. Just go and meditate anyway. So if your meditation is dependent on you having some kind of enthusiastic emotion about wanting to meditate, then that's not going to last, because that emotion is going to change. We need a deeper, more lasting motivation, a deeper, more lasting framework. And if we don't find that, then we'll come with enthusiasm, excitement and thrill and faith to practice, and we're faced with two options. One is to leave, which is what most people do, and then which is the best thing to do, or the worst thing to do is to stay, and to stay unordained, or stay in the monastery without any faith, without any inspiration, and without anything else to guide and support you, and just kind of grind on, endure, grit your teeth, and just stay there because you can't think of anything better to do. And that's a very sad conclusion to spiritual life, but it happens. So don't let that be you. Don't be one who looks back and thinks, actually, I had that great opportunity and I just blew it. Don't think that you're somebody special. Don't think that you're someone better. You're not. We're all just ordinary people here. We haven't got special qualities. We're not, special enlightened beings or anything like that. We're just ordinary people. The Buddha talked about the four kinds of ways of practice. The painful way of practice with slow insight, the painful way of practice with swift insight, with pleasant practice with slow insight, and the pleasant practice with swift insight. So most of us, if we're honest, we say, well, we're probably in the slow practice and painful practice with slow insight. Whatever. It doesn't really matter. The main thing is that there's practice. It doesn't matter whether it's enjoyable or not, whether you feel you're getting results or not, or all of these things. Just throw all those feelings out. Just keep on practicing anyway. So we should make sure that our practice, the orientation of our spiritual life, is founded on really secure foundations and not on shifting sand. And one thing that means is that it's founded not on just a bunch of opinions and views that you've inherited without scrutiny and without really thinking about it, nor is it based on the kind of blind acceptance of the views or opinions of somebody else. And as you know, for myself, I think it's so important that everything we do is based primarily on the Buddha's teachings, on the suttas, the Vinaya, and that those teachings that be studied very carefully, very deeply, not just in a shallow way, but to treat them as something very important. That means to engage with it on a variety of levels, through reading, through contemplation and reflection, through discussion, through analysis, through chanting. All of these different ways of engaging with the teachings that have exercise different aspects of our mind and continually reinforce and practice in different ways meaning of what's been talked about. And so this is the best means and essential means of banging out, getting rid of the silly ideas and irrelevant and nonsensical notions that we have filling our mind that we picked up from here and there and from all the influences that we've had. And so we need to have a good framework, a Buddhist framework. It makes sense, it's very logical, it's very balanced, it's very reasonable. And so we need to keep on investigating, keep on inquiring within ourselves. Is this way that we're thinking, the way that we're pursuing things, is this really in accordance with the Dhamma? But of course that aspect of it is only part of it, but it's a critical part. And it's a part, in my opinion, that so many people, especially in the forest tradition, have just ignore. And they pretend that it's not there, pretend they don't have views, pretend they don't have opinions. And then they go on for many years, and then you listen to what you say and you find out actually they've got a lot of views and a lot of opinions, but they're just not very sensible ones. So this is a part of our mind we need to exercise. We need to treat it with dignity. But then that's only part of it, only part of the story, and all of the other path factors also we have to put into practice as well, like right intention. It's so important to think of how are we relating to other people, what kind of motivation do we have? Are we really treating others with kindness, with gentleness? Is that the orientation of our life, of our spiritual practice? Are people going to come and visit here and visit Santi Monastery and then go away and say, oh, there's all these grumpy, rude monks and nuns there. They're very arrogant and dismissive and they yell at you when you do something wrong. Is that the kind of impression that people are going to go away from when they come to the monastery? Because these things always manifest externally, don't they? So remember that these attitudes of kindness, acceptance, the kind of the warmth that we can extend to people, the support we can extend when people need support, these things we need to keep on striving, keep on trying to do more, keep on trying to be better. And so remember that all of the practices that we do and the externals of the monastic life are only for helping to support these inner development, really. Yes. Okay, that's not 100% true. There's a sense in which it's also there to be an inspiration and a model for people, and so there is some importance to the externals of it. But by far the most, but that should never be dominant. That's just a kind of a side thing, really. By far the most important thing is how we're actually training internally. And it's something that I've noticed in monasteries that I've been at and that I've seen is that in some cases it's possible to live your monastic life so that those externals become not something which is there to support your practice, but which become the practice itself, they become the end itself. And somebody who's a good monk or a good nun is somebody who does the right things, who washes their bowl the right way and puts their robe on the right way and does all the duties the right way and so on and so forth. So of course we should all do those things. We should all try to actually do these things the best way we can. But that's not what the holy life is about. Actually, it's very easy to go and you can find a hotel or an army barracks or a jail or a business or something like that or just an ordinary house where everything is so refined and so precise and so clean and so well organized and so tidy. And yet there's no spiritual development going on whatsoever. It's very common. So these things, these externals, have got nothing to do with spiritual development, to be honest. And there are plenty of rishis and sages who've gone off and lived in caves and forests and so on, who never concern themselves with these things at all. Wouldn't even cross their mind. So the reason we we care about the externals of the holy life. We want to keep the Vinaya rules, we want to make sure we do the duties and so on. So we do that to support our practice, and also, very importantly, to support other people's practice. Because living here in a community, how we behave and the kinds of things we do really has a big effect on others. Whether we're talking when others are trying to be silent, it's a major thing. You know, you hear that again and again and again. That's what people say, is that, you know, it's very hard for them to practice mindfulness because people are talking all the time. Have you ever done that? Have you ever been in a case where you've been trying to be mindful and focus on what you're doing, and it's just so distracting and so hard to do it because there's talking and so on going on in the background? So if you've ever been in that situation, then please spare a thought for others as well when you're talking and chatting. There are some places where that's normal. You know, if we're in the office and doing some work or something and then we need to talk or whatever. So there are places where there's a time and place. But the default in a monastery, the default setting is to not talk. So just don't. When you're washing up, don't talk. When you're cooking, don't talk. When you're cleaning, don't talk. That should be the normal way of doing things. And if you need to speak or say something, then from time to time, mindfully, then say something. You don't need to be paranoid about it. You don't need to go around, you know, worrying that you might say something. If you need to say it, just say it. Just be normal. But just have that mindfulness to just check that gushing torrent of dribble that just spurts out of all of our mouths if we don't watch it. So this is one of the kindest things that we can do while staying in a monastery. Is to offer each other the gift of silence. So no one's going to create this space for you if you don't do it yourself. I mean, we can do everything that we possibly can. And we have done everything we possibly can. We've got, you know, beautiful bushland, we've got seclusion, we have the silence, the space, the time, you've got plenty of time. Everyone here has plenty of time during the day to do all the meditation that they need to do. We've got the books and everything we need to do, if we need to do study, and all, so many resources for spiritual practice, which are, you know, far, far beyond what you find in almost any other place. So, but nobody can make you make use of those things well. If you want to spend your time well, it's up to you. So this is one of the things I've always been very conscious of here, is that I want to make a monastery for grown-ups. I don't want to make a monastery for little kiddies who have to be told what to do all the time. And, you know, again, you can see that if you're in monasteries where people are told what to do all the time, and there are a lot of monasteries like that, then at the end of the day, people don't know how to think. They become like little kids. You're treated like little kids all the time. You become like little kids. You can't make decisions. You can't think for yourself. You can't form your own opinion or idea about things. You can only do it the way that it's been done. You can only think the way that the thought has been laid out for you. So again, I want you to appreciate the fact that this monastery is not like that. Okay? That we're not treating you like little kiddies. And I'm not, trying to kind of monitor you and check your homework and things like that. Like a story we heard at drinks time about the kids in India who would get the comic books which were shaped like the school textbook. And so you'd sit up at the back of the class with this comic book and reading that instead of reading the textbook. So if any of you guys want to do that, then you go ahead. I'm not kind of checking on you. I'm not sort of like a teacher wandering around with a big stick and going to hit you if you're not reading the right textbook. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what are you doing here? You know, if you're not interested in what's being taught, if you're not interested in the study and the practice that we have here, then why bother? What are you wasting your time for? What are you wasting all our time for? So it's been my experience that most of the people who come to a monastery like this have overcome a lot of challenges to get here. That it's not something that we just drift into. It's not something that we you know, kind of pushed into by our culture or circumstances. It's something we have to leave behind a lot. We have to sacrifice a lot just to get here. Many of you have travelled from the other side of the world to come here. And we've left behind our families, our career, our study, all of those things we've left behind to come here. It's because we think it's important. And so this is another reason why I want to build, base the monastery on trust and base the community on trust. It's a trust that I know that people only come here if they really have a good motivation. And so I trust that that motivation will carry people through. But you need to work at it. Don't just think that that original inspiration that you had is just going to last. It's not. Definitely not. Absolutely. And so you need something else that's going to carry you through. On a practical level, that means that we have to have things that we're interested in and work that we do that is going to be meaningful and nourishing for us, and as well as the meditation. We can't just, most of us, with a few exceptions, but most of us can't just meditate and do nothing else all the time. And so we have to have something. For some people that's service for the community, for some people that's offering counselling and services, being an ear for people to speak to. For some people it's teaching, for some it's writing or studying Dhamma. For others it may be something more practical, helping out with a building in the monastery, or various things that need to be done, and get a sense of satisfaction from serving the community and serving the Sangha like that. So there can be many things that are done, and as you know, there are many things that actually that are done in a monastery. So you need to cultivate those positive interests that will help. They'll be a help for you, be a sustenance for you. Find joy in them. Don't treat them as just a distraction. And so all of those things, that kind of holistic approach we have to Dhamma and to Buddhism, they're all part of the long-term strategy. And so these are things which, you know, you're not necessarily going to figure out immediately. You know, it'll take a few years. Gradually we try a few things, maybe go around, stay in a few places or whatever. And then gradually things will settle down. And you sort of realize, oh, actually, I really have an interest in studying Pali or in the Chinese scriptures, or I have a real interest in doing some prison counseling work, or I have a real interest in helping out with the buildings in the monastery, and so many different things that we can be doing. So gradually, we tend to find those things that we're interested in, and to be able to focus on, and to use those skills and those interests in a beneficial way, in a positive way. So it's very, you know, it is very interesting to notice how different people relate to these things. You know, for example, at chores time, is the chores time just something you do to fill in because you're told to do it and that's what you have to do and you're in a monastery? Or are you actually doing it as part of your practice? Are you actually doing it with a sense of service and helping, and with a sense of using it as a mindfulness practice? And I always remember, this for me was really crystallized once when I was at Bodhinyana, and there was some work going on one of the kutis, and they were doing some bricklaying, and Ajahn Brahm was there laying bricks, and some of the other monks were there doing various jobs. And it was so striking to me that there was Ajahn Brahm laying bricks and all the other monks talking. And all the other monks were chatting about this and that, and probably, I think they were chatting about like arupa jhanas, or formless attainments, and things like that. And of course, there was only one person present who possibly had any experience of those things, and that was Ajahn Brahm, and he was the one laying the bricks. And that's not a coincidence. Because when he meditates, when he lays bricks, there's clear comprehension. No, not when you're laying bricks to be chatting about meditation, and then when you're meditating, you're probably thinking about laying bricks. It's called confusion. So it's very, very important to notice this. When you're working, what are you actually doing? Just to work, to get that job done the best possible way that you can. And that's how you practice the Eightfold Path in that moment. And as we all know, and Ajahn Brahm talks about in his Dhamma talks, that he actually uses this. He goes away and uses his service as a meditation. He recollects all the things, good things that he's done to help people and the work that he's done, and this puts his mind in a positive and uplifted frame of mind, and then that powers his meditation along. So this is the right way of practicing. So one of the things that that's important as if we're thinking about this kind of long-term perspective on our Dhamma practice is that there always be this mind that is wanting to learn, this mind that is open and is not closed off. And this is another one of the pitfalls that monastic life can get into. And we can get into a state where we're very closed-minded, we're very inward-looking, where there's a concern within the community and all the kind of the little niggling little issues and the kind of all the kind of the gossipy and trivial little details that happen, and we sort of our mind sort of starts circling in smaller and smaller circles around these things, and we forget the big picture. The Buddha was a big picture man. If you look at the suttas, he usually starts out when he just teaches off the spontaneously, and he usually teaches in a fairly teaches about important things, teaches about birth, aging and death, teaches about the critical matters of life. Yeah? He doesn't talk about what kind of bamboo pole you can hang your robes on in your kuti. He only does that when they have to. And he has to, and there's passages in the Vinaya where it goes into all those details, but whether or not they're authentic, but anyway, they only happen when people come to him and complain and raise the issues, and then he'll respond to those little details. But if you just leave him to speak about what he wants to speak about, like in the Dhammacakka, he speaks about avoiding the two extremes, developing the Eightfold Path, realizing the Four Noble Truths. And so he keeps his mind, what's the big picture, what's the actual really important things that we're here for, really important things in our life. Again, remembering that simile that Ajahn Brahm gives of the jar with the stones. So you kind of put the big stones in the jar first, and then if there's room for the little stones and bits of gravel and sand, then they can go in after. So the important things. Make sure we focus on the important things. And so the mind, that kind of mind which becomes narrow and defensive, and which sort of thinks, oh, we've got it all right and others have got it all wrong, this is the right way to practice, that's the wrong way to practice, and so on. You look at these, the way the Buddha criticized this kind of thinking so many times in the suttas, and yet you find it all the time in monasteries. You go to almost every monastery I've been to have these kinds of attitudes. So this way is right and that way is too strict, or that way is too slack, or this way of doing this is right and that way is doing it's wrong. This kind of conceit about having the best way of doing things. And of all the monasteries that I've been at, Santi is the only monastery that doesn't have that conceit of thinking that it's better than everywhere else. The reason being, of course, because we are in fact better than everybody else, so it's not conceited to think so. So very important to know that. So this is why it's important to have to have that openness. And yes, of course, we base our foundation, our studies on the suttas and our practice and living in the forest and things, but we have things to learn from other people. Which is why we have talks from time to time. Invite Justine to come and talk about Nietzsche, or have someone to come and talk about Aboriginal spirituality, and this is why I get involved in the interfaith events and all of these things. And so you might get really hardcore about it. You might think this is all a distraction, this is not what the Buddha taught, blah, blah, blah. But you find that when the people who think like that and who say those kinds of things, they tend to have very constricted and very narrow minds, the very kind of hard ways of thinking. Whereas if you look at how the Buddha actually operated, the Buddha was very engaging with the different ideas and people who were around him at the time. The suttas are constantly, almost every sutta, or almost all of the longer suttas, consist of the Buddha in dialogue, very often with non-Buddhists or else with Buddhist lay people and monastics and so on, discussing ideas, looking different ways of looking at things, asking questions. And of course, as the famous phrase that the Buddha used in his teaching so often, Tanking Manyasi, what do you think? What do you reckon? What do you reckon? Literally, it's almost a literal translation of Tanking Manyasi, is what do you reckon? And so the Buddha took the people's opinions seriously. He sort of used this model of interrogating, asking questions, getting people to respond. And so there's an active engagement with the teachings, not just a sort of passive absorption of them. And so that keeping that mind active and engaged, considering things, different aspects of things and new perspectives and so on, this is part of what keeps things fresh. And again, that's what keeps the mind interested, exercising your brain. And again, if you see people who don't do that, and who lock their mind down more and more and more in just sort of very sort of stereotype ways of thinking, and it becomes harder and harder to change that. The more that your mind sort of just goes down one track, then the harder it is to change that later in life. And so, of course, the problem or the issue is that of course, while you're thinking, reflecting, discussing about philosophy or something, well, then some people think, well, it's not peaceful, so you need to make your mind peaceful in meditation. That's true to some degree. It's true on a immediate level. Obviously, when we're talking and discussing at that time, then the mind isn't as peaceful as it is in meditation. But if you look in terms of a longer term development, then that's not true at all. In terms of a longer term development, we actually need to have that capacity to think, to inquire, to reflect. And this goes hand in hand with developing the stillness of the mind in meditation. So don't confuse that kind of contingent short term what may be seen as a conflict or a choice, but in the long term, both of those things are things we need to develop. And actually, it's usually not such a big problem. The critical thing in developing how to meditate and to still our mind in meditation is learning to understand your mind, to understand awareness, and to apply your mind in meditation in the right way. If you can do that, then you can come out of a discussion or a contemplation or something and then come and apply your mind in meditation, and it's not so difficult, it's not so hard. What's a bigger problem is not, in fact, in monastic life, is not discussing a philosophy and discussing Dhamma and opinions about Dhamma, but it's all the discussion and so on not Dhamma or not philosophy or things that are meaningless. And these are the things where you're not doing something for a purpose with clear comprehension, but where you completely lost your clear comprehension and just allowing time to drift on and the mind to drift on and the mouth to drift on for no purpose and no benefit. And this is the real danger that I see in monastic life. And again, just to reflect that on a short-term perspective, well, it's a waste of time and it's maybe annoying other people and so on to just be going on chatting about nothing. But oh well, that's not the end of the world. But in the long term, then you have to ask, well, what's the long term implications? If you're just sort of sitting there wasting time like that all the time, then where are you going to be in 5 years' time? Where are you going to be in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time? And again, just to think back to the classroom situation, you can have some kids at the back reading a comic book, Well, it's not such an evil thing to do to read a comic book for a while instead of studying, We've all done things like that. But what's the long-term outcome if every day you go to school and you read comic books and you don't actually study, where are you going to be in 5 years' time? Where are you going to be in 10 years' time? What's the actual outcome of that? Well, of course, the outcome is you're not going to learn anything. The outcome is you're going to be ignorant. So the same thing is going to be applying in spiritual practice, in your life in the monastery. If we don't take that chance to learn when we have the chance, if we don't take the chance to meditate when we have the chance, we don't have to take the chance to practice when we have the chance, then the time will run out on us. In 5 years' time or 10 years' time, where are we going to be? People that will be looking to us and thinking, oh, you know, she's been ordained for 10 years already, you know, she must have good meditation, must have some experience. Is that going to be the case? Or are you going to say, well, actually, no, I've been, you know, here for 10 years, but, you know, I always never got seemed to get around to sorting my meditation practice out. It wasn't convenient. Something came up. And now 10 years later, I've lost the initial enthusiasm that I had. I'm a bit kind of older, a bit more jaded, a bit more cynical, and, you know, got a bit less energy, my health's not so good. And am I going to start my meditation now? So this is something for us all to reflect, to think about, and to think about what actually is going to happen to us. What's going to happen in the over the long term, over the decades. So this is what we're here for. Meditation. It's not like a meditation retreat. Next week, and I'll go and I'll teach a meditation retreat, and it'll just be for 1 week. So for that 1 week, I'm going to treat that 1 week very differently from how I treat life here in the monastery. In that 1 week, we're going to do away with everything and try to focus completely just on doing meditation only. We're not going to be having discussions. We're not going to be having any kind of distraction or anything. Just meditation. But that's only for 1 week. You know, you can't just do that always. There's only very few people who can do that always, just constantly, year in, year out. Do that for a short period of time, then we come away, we can reflect on what we've learnt from that. So when the Rains Retreat is coming up, not so long now, and we'll be starting to think about how we want to organise things and how we want to spend our time during the Rains Retreat. And so that will be the time when we'll be wanting to focus on the meditation 100%. In the meantime, then there are things to be done, and projects and work and various things. So put attention and care into those things as best we can as well. So this is just a few reflections for you this evening on the monastic life and the holy life, and just reflections on that. Just knowing the difference between the short term and the long term, and thinking about having a framework and a way that we can be happy and we can live comfortably and profitably while developing and advancing in our Dhamma practice. So I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite for any comments and questions.
Bhagavato Sangha Sangho.